Okay. So, Pante, we have some collected questions and in chat also have. So, can I start, Pante?
Yes.
Okay. So, few questions like first question, Pante, why can't woman become a Buddha?
It's that's a difficult one. I start off with a difficult one. All I can say is it's the law of nature. You know, why is there only one moon? Why is there we have only one sun? Why is water wet? Why is the sun hot? This is just the nature of things. But I think that I shouldn't forget that also 99.999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999% of men will not become Buddha either. But what is important is that women can become Sotapanna, can become Sakitagami, can become Anagami, can become Arahant. And I think this is a much more important point to make. So, yeah, women can't become Buddhas, but neither can most men. It's only one in millions out of millions out of millions can become Buddha.
Okay. Second question. Bande, how to make a letting go process stronger?
Letting go is quite a, I think it's a more difficult practice than is often acknowledged. And the foundation for letting go is patience. So the development of patient endurance must come first. That why I say that letting go is probably more difficult than people think, because there is just putting aside or replacing some attachment, and there's often not a genuine letting go. So the genuine letting go is one in which we see very clearly the suffering inherent and inseparable from attachment, and we see the value of freedom from that attachment. So there has to be that clear seeing and that disenchantment. So, and what I mean by disenchantment, maybe I could convey with an analogy. If we watch a magic trick and we cannot see how the magic trick is performed, then we can watch that trick again and again and again and enjoy it every time. But the moment that we can catch the sleight of hand, the technique, the means by which the magician is deceiving us, then we no longer want to watch that magic trick anymore. It has no charm. It has no interest for us. And this is the letting go that we should aim for. But in the meantime, then it's to begin with, to repeat, this ability to maintain a normal mind, an unaffected, stable awareness of what is unpleasant. And that gives us foundation for many virtues. It allows us to see in more depth the nature of the phenomena. And as I say, in particular, the suffering which we are creating for ourselves through attachment to it. In the beginning, we may have to use a replacement technique, such as replacing sensual thoughts with thoughts of the unattractiveness of the body, or replacing angry thoughts with thoughts of loving kindness. But this is a step towards letting go rather than the letting go itself.
Oh, okay. Nice. there's a question, Bhante. Bhante, how to reduce result of karma means if someone did a bad karma and he have he always in a stress that he thinking that he did bad. So is it any way to reduce the effect of bad karma?
Yes, the purification of karma. The Buddha detailed three important steps. The first is to take full responsibility for the conduct, for the bad karma that we create, not to blame anybody else. Secondly, to reveal it, not to conceal it, to reveal it to our teacher or to a trusted spiritual friend. And the third step, and most importantly, is to make a firm determination not to commit that karma again. And that third step is the critical one, and it also needs to be accompanied by some analysis of the causes and conditions that led one to make that bad karma in the first place. So it's not just a matter of making a resolution but not changing your lifestyle or not neglecting the spiritual powers that you need to cultivate to protect you from that kind of pressure or temptation in the future. There is also an important analogy given by the Lord Buddha, which, if I may summarize, is that if we compare the results of karma we created in the past to a spoonful of salt, and if we tip that spoonful of salt into a glass of water, the taste of the water will change immediately. It will become salty water. But if we were to tip that same spoonful of salt into a large water tank and then to open the tap and to drink from the water, then the taste of the water would not be any different. It would still taste like normal water. So it is not that the salt has disappeared, but it has become diluted to such an extent that it is no longer cognizable, it's no longer recognized as such, experienced as such. And so here we have the idea that for someone who is not practicing the Dhamma, then their mind is like a small vessel, like a small glass. And so the impact of previous bad karma is very strong, noticeable. Whereas someone who cultivates the Eightfold Path is, as it were, increasing the amount of water and can so dilute the bad karma created in the past so that it is not experienced as dukkha in the present.
Pandey, what is the difference between letting go and non-grasping?
And
non-grasping.
Oh, I think you can use them interchangeably.
Okay.
So I mean they're just different tenses of the same verb, if you like. If we talk about letting go, then there is the assumption that there has been some grasping, and we realize and we let go of that grasping, whereas non-grasping assumes that the mind is already in that state of non-attachment, and then preventing the future arising of grasping.
Pandey, one person asked that, what happens if person die in confusion?
It depends. That's the classic Buddhist answer, isn't it? What does it depend upon? There is an important sutta in which the Buddha's relative, Mahanama, the Sakyan, who was at that time a Sotapanna, he confessed to the Buddha that sometimes when he went into the busy marketplace, his mind would get confused. And he asked the Buddha, what would happen if I was to pass away at that time? And the Buddha said that that momentary confusion in his mind would have an insignificant result. So we cannot look at that moment of confusion separately or independently of all of the mental states and the acts of karma that have preceded it. If the mind is generally being looked after, cared for, cultivated correctly, a momentary experience of confusion will not have a significant karmic effect. But if that moment of confusion at death is the culmination of many, many moments of confusion preceding it, then it will have a significant karmic effect. Whether that will lead to rebirth in a human realm or another lower realm, as I say, is dependent on a great many other causes and conditions. If that person has kept the five precepts, for instance, and generally led a good life, then it will not mean that they will be unable to take a human life or even life as a deva. But if preceding that they have not applied themselves to the precepts or to any kind of cultivation, then yes, maybe not such a positive outcome. Excuse me.
Okay. Pandey, there's another question that if a person have wisdom but he not have any meditation experience, does it happens because of his past practices?
Well, the word wisdom is quite an imprecise word. If we're talking about panya, then they would have to investigate what level of panya we are talking about. So the general level of intelligence and the ability to think without logical fallacies and to be able to examine things carefully and thoroughly, etc. Just basic mental skills, good thinking skills. These are not necessarily the result of meditation practice, and they can be inherited from past lives, but also from the family background, from parents teaching good thinking skills, and from their education. But the kind of banya which will cut through delusion, cut through defilement, that kind of wisdom will not really develop without meditation. This because it requires a stability and clarity of mind, which will not occur naturally or except in only very rare cases, like fluke for the ordinary person. So maybe could compare samadhi or meditation to an anesthetic. So before there were general anesthetics, surgery was quite primitive. But once anesthetic became available, then surgery became much more sophisticated, because the surgeon could work on a body that was still and without pain for many hours at a stretch. And similarly, when the mind has been developed through meditation, it can maintain a stability and stillness that allows for the work of wisdom to take place on a much more profound level. The investigation of impermanence and dukkha and anatta is possible in a way that the untrained mind cannot experience.
Bhante, how to maintain consistency and continuity in our Dhamma practice?
Well, my teacher gave the best advice, I think, on this topic, and he would say, when you feel diligent and inspired, you practice, and when you feel lazy and discouraged, you practice. So you don't give that kind of weight and significance to your feelings about the practice. So this is not, I think, an unrealistic goal. If you consider the life of most people in the world, let's say rice farmers, every day they have to go to work, and some days it's pouring with rain in the rainy season, or extremely hot, and sometimes they don't want to go to work, but they do, because if they don't go to work, then they won't have any harvest. They won't be able to feed themselves or their family. So because they see their work as being necessary to life itself, I think very few farmers would give much importance to those feelings. Oh, today I don't want to go to the field. I don't want to work on my rice paddy or my rice field. I feel lazy. Those feelings would arise, but because they're not even considered, worthy of consideration, they just fade away. So when you see when you can come to see the importance and the absolute necessity of Dhamma practice and the urgency of Dhamma practice, when you appreciate what great good fortune you have to be born as a human being and to have come into contact with the Buddha Dhamma, and to have teachings from wise and compassionate teachers, then even though those feelings of discouragement and laziness arise, then they take no hold in the mind, and just as they would take no hold in the mind of someone who is working to feed themselves and their family.
Bhante, then another question. Why Westerners practice Dhamma more than Asians?
Do they?
I don't know.
I doubt it.
The question said, why Westerners practice Dhamma more than Asians? I also don't know about it.
Yeah, I'm questioning the basic premise behind this question. I don't think that there are that many Westerners who are practicing the Dhamma. Maybe they're just more prominent. Yeah. But, I think there's a constant mistake in making comparisons. So in Thailand, you have a small number of Western monks but they're very prominent just because of physical appearance and because before a Westerner will come to Thailand to become a monk, then there's, a great deal of pruning out. And so the only the really dedicated ones make their way into monasteries, whereas in Thailand generally, you have so many monks, and many of them are ordaining for a short time, or maybe they don't have such great faith and determination. So if you take a normal everyday Thai monk and then one of the Western monks and compare them, then the Western monks can seem much more diligent and devoted and practicing harder. But then if you were to take the 300,000 Thai monks and sift out the ones who are really dedicated and really devoted to practice, they would be far more than the Western monks. And maybe the Western monks would not stand up to the comparison so well. So, whenever we make comparisons like this, we have to make sure that we're comparing like to like. And this is a problem throughout Asia, and it's for the last 100 years that people have been taking like the worst of Asia and comparing it with the best of the West and feeling inferior. And I think that's had tragic results in many, many areas of life.
Bhante, this is not my questions. Bhante, another question. My 15-year-old daughter do practice, but 20-year-old daughter do not inclined to practice. I don't understand what pulls her back.
Well, I wonder whether the questioner was practicing when he or she was 20 years old. Probably not.
No.
So, expecting your daughter to be more intelligent than you are, I don't know. This is not a matter of IQ. Dependent on so many factors, and emotional maturity is one factor, and the sometimes some people need some shock or some disappointment or unhappiness in life before they will see the value of Dhamma. So there are people have very different capacities. Some people, even from a young age, are drawn to Dhamma and Dhamma practice. Some people see the suffering of others or of a family member or the illness or death of someone they love. And then they turn to Dhamma practice. Other people have to get sick themselves or have some bad experience before they wake up. And some people can live their whole life without ever waking up at all or even acknowledging that there is such a thing as waking up. So people have different faculties. I think that the best thing that you can do is show through your own life, through your kindness, your compassion, your wisdom, your patience, that Dhamma has had a really positive effect on your life. And this is something you can share. Whether or not it would have the same effect on your daughter's life or not is something else. But at least you can try to be an example. And I'm sure, as you know, if you brought up children, then what you do makes far more of an impression than what you say. So if you live the Dhamma and express the Dhamma in your life, then it may well be that your daughter will come to appreciate it. But when you're 20 years old, you've got your whole life in front of you and you've got ideas about study, working, and careers, and all. You're in that stage of life where most people are not yet ready for this, but the key piece of advice I would give you, I think, is that if we're talking about Buddhism, then we start off as the Buddha himself started off by talking about suffering. Does your daughter have any suffering in her life? Is there things that cause her pain, that make her anxious and stressed out, or she finds depressing? And then talk about her experience of life and how she deals with the unpleasant side of life, fears and anxieties and stress and so on, and say, the Buddha has some really good advice on how to deal with this kind of issue. And, you know, is that interesting to you, or do you have your own strategy for dealing with the pain and the suffering in your life? Are you confident going forward that you have an inner refuge that's going to see you through all the ups and downs of your life? Or is there a way of giving yourself an inner refuge and stability that will help you in the future, no matter what path your life will take?
Another question from same person, Bhante. Will you like to share your experience staying alone? Bhante, you're staying alone, so they want to want to know about that.
Yeah, these days I'm not completely isolated. I mean, I see people quite a lot, but yeah, I just like my own company. I'm my best friend, and so I've always been this way. But I think that for monastic training, you know, as a teacher, I've always emphasized that monastics, and I think that this point also would include lay meditators, that you should only really go into solitude or lead a more solitary life when you can live in a community without suffering or without, but being able to practice in community, because when people go into solitude because they cannot handle the defilements that come up in relating to other people, and then they quote the Buddha and they go off by themselves, and if they used to maybe argue with other people, then they start arguing with themselves, or else they become rather kind of stiff and rigid and attached to views and opinions and get rather conceited. So there are many traps for someone living in solitude, just as there are many traps for those living in community. And the idea is that we have to be fluent and able to adapt to both. So although I enjoy solitude a lot, then I do go out and I do spend time with other people, because that's the best test also. You know, that does anything come up when I'm with other people that doesn't come up when I'm by myself? So the overriding intention is always the cultivation of the heart and the abandonment of defilement.
Can a person in depression be cured or healed through meditation alone to an extent that he does not need to a psychologist, doctor, or medicine?
It's important not to put too much hope and expectation on meditation techniques. The application of meditation in a context of the overall training in the Eightfold Path, and that includes how we relate to our bodies, how we relate to the people around us, how we relate to technology, how we relate to the environment. So meditation is just one part of that. And for someone who's depressed, then the most important thing is to get out of your room. Don't just sit there, just allowing your mind to kind of sink into the mud and the sludge of depression. You need to exercise, get out of the house, and most importantly, do things for other people, kind actions for others, putting other people's suffering at the center of your life rather than your own, not allowing yourself to be the center of the universe so much. And so eating well, exercising well, keeping precepts, helping other people, these are all parts of the Buddha's cure for depression. But helping others, it brings a joy into the mind and is a very effective way of dealing with this. But with depression, the most effective therapy that's been developed over the past years is what they call MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And that's an integration of Buddhist mindfulness practices with the cognitive therapy, which is based upon the idea that we attach to certain negative thoughts about ourselves and believe in them very much. And that believing that I'm terrible, I'm hopeless, nothing's ever going to change, etc. And believing in these so much is a root cause of depression or recurrent chronic depression. And that recognizing these thoughts as being simply thoughts in the mind is recognized now as being the most effective means of dealing with depression. So there is a distinction, of course, between like a one-off depression dependent upon a certain kind of traumatic events, which would be a death or losing your job or having some difficult period in your life, and chronic depression where it's recurring throughout your life. So the one-off kind of depression maybe can respond to drugs, but the chronic depression needs that ability to recognize and let go of certain very harmful false thoughts in the mind. So I would not say that meditating and meditating for half an hour every day in the morning, evening, or even more than that, if it's not carried on in conjunction with other skillful means of dealing with your life in the world, that it will have a good effect and may even have a negative effect. Certainly for people with more serious mental problems, then meditation is counterindicated. It's not a good thing. It's if someone has serious mental problems, you should actively prevent them from meditating because it will often make their condition worse.
Some question from other country people, Bhante, so I take them now. Bhante, Bhante, previously I did half year 8 preceptor and meditation in 2 different country monastery. After returning back to own country, I could not adapt back for several months. On top of that, the mind also reacts slowly to normal life happening. What did I done wrongly? After that, when I adapted back to normal life, I afraid to do meditation again.
Yeah, I don't know whether I'd be confident about answering this question without a lot more information about what you did in the monastery's practice, what your idea of normal life is. These are all important factors to take into consideration. I'll just make a guess that, or based upon people that I know who've spent time in monasteries and meditation centers, is that if you are frustrated that your daily life or your home life is not supporting your meditation practice, or you find that you cannot be as mindful or as peaceful as you were in the monastery, then you start to resent your family, or you resent your work, and you become filled with this kind of negativity, and then that often leads to just to go back to the monastery again and get away from this. So that's one dynamic that I've observed. And so if the emphasis is too much on the development of samadhi, and there is not enough effort on developing this mindfulness in daily life and observation of the mind and learning to investigate the three characteristics and looking on Dhamma practice in its fullness of development of our relationship to the physical world, our relationship to the social world, cultivation, the abandonment of negative emotion, cultivation of positive emotion, the wisdom, that if our experience in a monastery is one of spending many hours every day sitting alone and practicing a particular meditation technique and developing quite refined, subtle states of mind, then when you leave the meditation center, you have to acknowledge that that's not going to be possible. This is why in the forest monasteries, you know, we have this more kind of rounded life with bindaba, arms round, and work periods and discussions, rather than simply having the monks sit and walk, or the lay meditators, without any kind of social interaction or any opportunity for developing those more basic life skills, which will come into, which will be much more needed once you are out of the meditation hall or the monastery itself.
Pandey, there is another question. When we feel pain or blockage in our body during meditation, what's the best way to deal with them?
With a blockage in the body?
Yes, they say that.
One method, simple method, is to do the kind of sweeping technique advocated by Mr. Goenka, and to spread the energy throughout the body, not to panic or to become obsessed with that blockage and then making it even worse. I think that generally, if there are blockages in the energy in the body, then exercises, yoga in particular, and qigong, tai chi, the Chinese forms of exercise, are very good for sustaining that energy flow in the body. So it's not so much that there's a kind of a technique for dealing with it, you know, when it arises, but the fact that it does arise suggests that we need to give more attention to the physical body than we are in terms of diet, exercise, and in particular those forms of exercise that work directly with the chakras and with the energy flow within the body.
Pandey, another question. How to control negative emotions or negative thoughts?
Well, negative emotion will, you know, are the pop up into the mind, let's say, then they are the results of karma created in the past. And that might be past life, it might be from childhood, it might be from this morning. But you create these kind of pathways and ruts which the mind will very easily fall into. So today, speaking with my group in Bak Chong, somebody from America was saying that many of her friends heard that the president of the United States had COVID, and they all felt good about it. And, you know, was that really bad karma? So, you know, we're saying the fact that you feel some pleasure in the suffering of another human being just spontaneously, you know, is the result of thoughts that you've cultivated in the past and indulged in, or speech and actions in the past. But the question is how you deal with that in the present. This is the newcomer. And so if you recognize the negative emotion or the negative thought that arises as simply the result of old karma, and you don't add on to it, you don't push it away or reject it or repress it, and you don't indulge in it and add on to it, then it will pass away in a natural, according to its nature. But when there are deep habits of negative emotion already accumulated, then we may need to create specific antidotes. But in any case, the method of dealing with defilement or negative emotion must include the practice of sila and of samadhi and of panya. So that on the external level, then we refrain, mindfully refrain from any action or speech which is prompted by that negative emotion. Because once we express it physically or verbally, then it has a life in the world. And these days, even more so than in the past, because when people feel negative emotion and then they post things on social media, then it can have long-lasting effects on their own well-being and relationships with others. So that restraint, mindful restraint of the expression of negative emotion is a very important part of dealing with it. And then in the area of samadhi, then we cultivate the positive emotion which directly counters that negative emotion. In the case of anger, then metta, loving kindness. If it's jealousy, then mudita, and so on. And the development of mindfulness and patience are always part of the of this cultivation. Then the third and most important, perhaps, element of this of solution is the development of wisdom and investigation to be able to see, for instance, the suffering that we inflict upon ourselves, how when we allow our mind to become caught up in the negative emotion, it's like we're poisoning ourselves, and that no good will ever come from it, and that our negative emotion is based upon an ignorance of or a blindness to the three characteristics. When we see the suffering that it causes and the beauty and the nobility of a mind which is free from that kind of negative emotion, maybe we can think of a teacher or someone who we look up to who doesn't have that kind of negative emotion, doesn't show it, and it's an inspiration and an example to us. And then it gives us that confidence that we can do that. We can abandon that negative emotion. So to sum up, we need to be working with our external expression of negative emotion. We need to be cultivating the virtues which will directly oppose the negative emotion or replace it. And we have to work upon the wrong, mistaken thoughts, assumptions, attachments which lie behind the arising of that negative emotion.
Another question, Pandit, is how should a Buddhist practitioner prepare the mind for dying and death? It's someone from Singapore.
Well, I mean, ideally, the possibility of death should always be in our mind. It should not be we should not experience the bereavement or separation from someone we love as like a great shock and surprise. And if we are practicing correctly, then we constantly have this sense of the fragility, the instability, the unpredictability of life. And so cultivating that sense of the preciousness, the uncertainty of life means that whenever death does come, then we are prepared for it. It's a natural thing. The more we attach to the five khandhas of the body and the mind, the more the sense of a separate, independent self seems very real to us, then the more fear of death there is, the more we can see that this body and this mind are just an unstable flow of phenomena, then the less fear of death that we have. So if we think that there is something here that is permanent, then impermanence is can be seen as threatening. Whereas we see ourselves as impermanence, it's like impermanence and impermanence. It's just one more expression of impermanence. So the extent to which we have worked hard to abandon what needs to be abandoned, and we've tried to cultivate all that is good and wholesome and purify our mind, then we have a sense, yeah, I've done the best I can. And won a few, lost a few, probably lost more than I won, but, you know, I've had a sense of sincerity and trying to make the best of our life means that we can approach our death with some peace and acceptance. So we want to be mindful and aware and patient and accepting and just dealing. And death is just one more signpost on the road. You know, it's just one more thing.
Okay. Pandey, how to control restlessness in daily life? how to control restlessness in daily life. There seems to be constant jumping of thought from one place to another in my life and always wanting to do something. If not, I feel unproductive.
Yeah, be unproductive. That's what's wrong with being unproductive. I mean, if what you're producing is garbage or rubbish, then better to be unproductive. So, you have to get a taste for quietness in the mind. You have to put some effort into meditation and to see that you don't have to keep something going in your mind all the time. You know, you're not justifying your existence because you're busy all the time. If you're just the effort to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, cultivate the mind, this is quite full justification for your existence as a human being. So cut down on social media. Cut down on things that stir your mind up without any beneficial result. Slow down, just and see what it's like. I might find it's a bit frightening to begin with, but after you try it, it's really great. And I think, it's like if you're going for a cold shower or something like that. You know, you put the cold water on and then. But then after a while it's kind of really good. You know, there's so many things we just, the first few seconds of it, first few minutes are difficult, and then you see the value of it. And there's a fear of there's a kind of a valuation of like thinking about anything is better than nothing. Nothing means death, and activity means life. So you've got to keep active all the time. It's better to do something. Anything at all is better than nothing. But there's a fallacy there. And so this is, you know, really one of the ways we can talk about practice of moving from doing to being. And you don't have to be, as I say, it doesn't mean if you're not thinking and doing and being active and busy and that you're wasting your life away. It's quite the opposite. So I would suggest more meditation, and so you can have more direct experience of that awareness and brightness and clarity and peace of mind, and that's definitely the way to go.
Another question, Pante. Pante, what made you realize that you have to become a monk?
I never wanted to do anything else. When I was a teenager, then there was a time I read this book. One of the books I read was by Jack Kerouac called Dhamma Bums, and this young man, he got a job in a fire tower. So he'd like go to this big forest in America, and they'd take him in on a helicopter, and then he goes up into this little cabin high above the trees, and then he just keeps his eye out for fires, takes a big suitcase of books with him, just hangs out reading and meditating, and then if there's a fire, then he sends a message on the radio. And I thought, I could do that. That's one job. And then the other job I thought I could do was when I read Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, and when he met this old man who rowed this boat from one side of the river to the other, taking pilgrims on their way. I thought that would be a good job. I could do that. Be a ferryman, take pilgrims from one side of a river to another. Or work as a lighthouse keeper. But then when I found out about the life of a monk and that you could, a Westerner like myself could go to Thailand and would be welcomed and accepted into the monastic order. And I realized that the life of a monk fulfilled all of the things that I was looking for, and more that I didn't even really consider when I first became a monk. And so that the life of a monk, the monastic culture, the ability to not only to practice well oneself, but to help other people. I just, from the very beginning, I thought, yeah, this is exactly what I've been looking for. And I, now 40 years have passed by, and I've never changed my mind. I'm just feel very fortunate to have been able to live my life in this way.
Pandey, another request is that there. Hello everyone, greetings from France. Pandey, a very selfish question. I discovered from some time now, you are very inspiring handwriting notes. Are they collected in a book or on a site? Would you allow me to translate them in a French? Thank you, Pandey.
Yes, so the background to this is that now having friends and students spread around the world, and the marvels of technology allow me to have some kind of relationship with people who I rarely get the chance to see in person. And I started writing these notes a few years ago now, firstly for students and people in China, and then it kind of expanded from that, and now they're posted for a group in Italy as well, and it's translated into Italian, and then this WeChat group which goes all around the world, in India and Russia and Brazil and all kinds of places. The last one person who joined was from Belarus, which is formerly part of the Soviet republics. So to answer the question, there have been two collections in books. The books are called From Heart and Hand, Volume 1, and From Heart and Hand, Volume 2. The first volume is definitely available as an ebook, and if you can find that online in the, I can't remember my own website, so it's like, maybe I'll send Deepak the link and he can send it out to people afterwards, but probably you can Google it anyway. So Ajahn Jayasaro, From Heart and Hand. And I think we have to make a proper archive, because more and more people are now asking this question. And there are one or two of my students who have been collecting everyone from the beginning, and maybe we can think to a way of making that available to those people who are interested.
Pandey, many questions, sir. They say that I face a lot of hindrances in my practice. Is that a result of my past unwholesome karma?
More likely your present unwholesome actions, I would say, probably. Yeah, I mean, we all have different stuff to deal with, and meditating and no hindrances, you know, that's not necessarily the goal. The people who have a kind of a natural samadhi from the beginning as the result probably of karma, good karma in the past life, then that's kind of good and smooth and enjoyable. But one of the downsides of it is that your ability to empathize with people who have a lot of problems and your ability to teach them will probably not be as much as someone who's had to deal with a lot of hindrances. So the meditation practice is designed as a way of exposing the hindrances. Hindrances arising throughout the day are very difficult to recognize because there's so much going on. But in meditation, where we simplify everything as much as we can, and then we make the mind, we give the mind an object, then thoughts and emotions and can be recognized as hindrances, and we can develop skillful means to protect the mind from the hindrances, and importantly, to learn skillful means to deal with hindrances that have arisen. So I would recommend you see the meditation as a kind of an exploration and a learning about how your mind works, because in the end, you know, we can only really abandon the defilements when we see them clearly. And so in the beginning, particularly of meditation practice, you have to be very patient, because this is the period where the old karma and the old negative thoughts and the old habits and things that we've accumulated will appear to the mind. And this is how we purify the mind, by learning how to be present to these kinds of unpleasant mental states, and learning to see them for what they are and letting go of them. So if we consider meditation as like the goal is to become peaceful and to develop jhana, and then if I can't do that, I'm a failure, then meditation becomes just one more worldly activity. You know, you have winners and I'm a loser because I've got hindrances in my mind. I'm hopeless. You know, so it just becomes another part of this kind of I'm hopeless story we tell ourselves about ourselves. So yeah, that's what's coming up today. You know, the hindrances are revealing things about ourselves that we really need to understand, and giving us the opportunity to develop skillful means to deal with them. So it's all right to have hindrances, but observe in your daily life if you are acting and speaking in ways which are feeding the hindrances. So before I mentioned about restlessness and agitation, and there's a definite relationship to use of social media and just being never giving your mind the chance to settle down and experience just the pleasure of a quiet mind. So if you're living in ways which are stimulating the hindrances and then meditating in order to reduce it or eliminate the hindrances, it's like there's a conflict there. There's a civil war going on in your mind. So, you know, you have to have everything going in the same direction, your life in the world, and your life in the meditation hall or in the meditation room.
Someone, a 7-year-old girl, asking about the heaven, hell, and nirvana.
Someone 7 years old?
7-year-old girl want to know about the hell, heaven, and nirvana.
Wow, okay. Well, let's say first of all that the Buddha says that you should never believe 100% in something that you haven't experienced for yourself. So when there are things that the Buddha taught us, then we have a lot of trust in the Buddha, that he is the greatest teacher And so we maybe believe like 90% or even 99%, but we don't go the whole 100% if it's something we haven't experienced for ourselves. So the Buddha taught about other realms that we can't, most people cannot experience. Heaven realms, hell realms, and the Buddha speaking from his own experience and telling us, giving us like a map or some idea of how things are. But as Buddhists, then our first job is always to be very truthful. And we can say, I believe in heaven and hell because I have trust in the wisdom of the Buddha, but I must acknowledge that I don't actually know. I don't know whether there's heaven or I don't know whether there's a hell. I believe there is because there's a lot of evidence to support it from the Buddha's teaching and from great meditators who have some experience of visiting other realms, but this is not my own experience. So first of all, if you find that heaven and hell and these ideas are very difficult to understand or to believe in, that's all right too, you know, but you don't either believe it 100%. As regards the comparison to Nibbana, heaven realms and hell realms, even though they may be, they last for a very long time, or at least one's experience of them, they are impermanent. So, like if you, whereas Nibbana is undying, it's not subject to birth or death. So we can compare, go to heaven is like going on holiday, basically, you know, going like 5-star resort by the sea, you know, everything's wonderful, people look after you, and yeah, but it's just that much, you know, and then, but then, for most beings, they don't have the barami, the ability to, progress in the Dhamma. In the heaven realm, it's just too pleasant, you know. You think in the human realm, where there's so many problems, and we still get lazy. So just think if you were in heaven, and it's just so blissful all the time, you know. Who would you want to meditate and work on your practice? Probably not. So. Heaven realm's okay, you know, it's like lovely, but it's just like postponing the work you have to do to realize Nibbana. And Nibbana is the highest happiness and is the greatest goal to aim for. So like, heaven realm is kind of good thing, but, it's not so good if you compare it with Nibbana. Whereas hell realm, yeah, so, this is why it's so important to keep 5 precepts in particular, because the 5 precepts are your safety net. As long as you keep 5 precepts, you can be sure, you know, you're not going to be reborn in a lower realm. And this is why it's incredibly important to always keep the precepts. So if the questioner is 7 years old, I'm very happy that you're taking an interest in this kind of topic, and I don't know whether I've explained it clearly enough for you, but maybe your parents can expand upon what I've explained right now in maybe a way easier for you to understand.
She doing a meditation every day, 30 minutes from 3 months, Pante.
I'm looking at my own image. I just seen there's a little box on the side, and
Sushant can Samayala anushakta
sama. Yeah, I just have the name. I don't have the.
This one.
Yeah. So is that clear explanation for you? Do you have anything else you'd like to ask?
always Mara.
Okay.
No, we don't ask questions. So, yeah, it's yes. clear.
Clear to
it's
her.
It's clear to her. We can explain her.
Okay.
Yeah. And they do.
Okay.
She's having a lot of questions.
Okay. Bande, another question is. How to come out of guilt, pain, shame, and get peace if one had done lots of bad to mamas in lifetime and now realize that he did wrong things in life? How to lessen the effect of past karma? That's the same question already answered by you, I think.
Yeah, let me just add one other reflection. When we look back at ourselves in the past, the really good question to ask is, am I the same person or a different person to the one that created the bad karma? So, and the classic answer first given in the questions of King Milinda is that you're not the same person and you're not a different person. So if you're not, obviously not the same physically, and your thoughts and emotions, everything is different today than it was at that time. But at the same time, you still have the same name, the same family, the same, you know, in conventional terms, you're the same person. But when we look at the relationship between the person we were in the past and the person we are now, and what we see is a continuity. And that continuity is composed of different physical and mental states in a flow, like a river. So if we look back at a day or an occasion where we did a really stupid or a bad thing, then if we look at it in terms of the mental states that were present in our mind, then we can say, oh yeah, on that day I had just so much restraint, just so much kiriyotapa or sense of shame and responsibility and patience, and I had this much greed or anger or jealousy or selfishness, and the unwholesome dhammas which were present at that moment were stronger than the wholesome dhammas. And so inevitably the unwholesome dhammas took the floor. It's like a committee, you know, and it's, and the dark side took over for that moment and led you to act in the foolish, destructive way. Now, when you look at it in those terms, and you don't think I'm a bad person because I did bad things and I've got to carry the memory of this around forever, you think there were in this flow of phenomena, which I call me in a conventional term, then I did foolish thing because I didn't cultivate the Dhamma. And I indulged in unwholesome dhammas. So in future, you know, this is my lesson. I have to find ways to reduce the power of the unwholesome dhammas and to develop the power of the wholesome, so that if a similar situation was to occur again, then the wholesome dhammas would win the day. They would have, they're more powerful. So this idea of this person who does bad things and is stained by the, you know, the bad action forever, that's just a very foolish and inaccurate way of looking at our life. But if we look in terms of what actually happens in terms of physical and mental states arising and passing away, it may seem kind of a weird way to look at things to begin with. But as you look more and more closely, you see it's most accurate representation of what's going on. You see, yeah, that the question is how to reduce and eliminate the unwholesome, to develop the wholesome, and to purify the mind.
Another question, Bhante. Thank you, Bhante. Just wondering, after we take five precepts, what happens to the unwholesome we did before? Can we reverse them at all?
Well, this is more or less the same question again. I mean, taking the five precepts, it means, when we have a ceremony, it just becomes a little bit more weighty and solid and meaningful in our life than if we just say, yeah, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm not going to do that anymore. And so psychologically, taking on the precepts and chanting them in the front of your teacher or the Buddha is a very skillful way of changing one's behavior and creating a new way of living in the world. So when we take the five precepts, then basically we are declaring to the world that we are not to be feared. So we give the gift of safety to all those around us. So you don't have to worry. Even if I'm angry with you, I won't ever hurt you physically or verbally. I won't steal from you. I won't cheat on you. I won't lie to you. I won't take alcohol, I won't drink or take drugs, which will make me unable to give you that kind of safety that I would like. So the keeping of precepts is a gift to all of those around you. The Buddha says it's the Mahadana. It's the greatest gift you can give, because everybody wants to feel safe. And no one can have any kind of peace in their life if they don't feel safe. So by keep taking precepts, you are creating safety for yourself, because you are no longer create the kind of karma which would result in unfortunate rebirth and in this life to all kinds of suffering and problems for yourself and others. And you're giving gift of safety. So this is very, very good karma. And so, as regards dealing with bad karma, then I've already spoken about this at some length, about creating new habits, about diluting the results of all karma with the new positive karma, and so on.
The lustful thoughts is the destructive for our spiritual practice. How do we curb the desire as a lay person, especially when we are not married?
Yeah, this depends on the standard that you want to take. And in detail, then as a lay person, is your standard going to be five precepts or eight precepts? And in you keeping the five precepts, then the standard is not to indulge in behavior which is taking advantage of anyone, or in ways in which the sexual or the sensual desire become like obsessions and create disruption and problems for yourself or others. So how that expresses in your how you live your life and how you relate to others, how you what standard you take for your sexual or your sensual life, then that will depend very much on your individual circumstance. But the most important thing is you're aware that sensual thoughts and feelings are incredibly powerful, and that repressing them is not a good idea, and just expressing them is not a good idea. And this is the challenge, to find the middle way. So I don't think that it's really possible for me to talk about this in too much detail in this kind of forum. But this is the general principle, that there's nothing that can upset and disturb and obsess the mind like sexual feelings. But they're also natural. If you're a young person, particularly, you know, this is part of your nature. And living in a world which your senses are being stimulated all the time, usually for some commercial benefit, profit, in whether it's advertisements and media and so on and so forth, you know, are using, trying to manipulate you, using that energy. So it's a matter of being mindful and being restrained and being aware of what stirs up your mind and what doesn't. And so your basic intention is, how can I take care of my mind? What is poisonous or what is upsetting and what is helpful?
Bande, one question from me. So here's the question, that conditioning creating the becoming, right? So how to stop that becoming then?
Well, the point of practice, if we're looking at this in terms of the paticca-samuppada, is the arising of craving. So with the sense contact through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, there is a feeling arising. That's a given. It's not a intentional act. We have feeling of pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling. And if craving arises based upon that feeling, then the attachment and the bhava, the becoming and the birth and the identification and so on, all these things will occur as a matter of course. So the important practice is that mindfulness at sense contact, and the mindfulness particularly in preventing the arising of craving in the feelings that arise attendant upon sense contact.
Bande, 1.5 hours already finished. Do you want to continue?
Okay.
There's a one question from a woman's a practitioner from group. So she said that some people making marriages, they are making arrangement for the marriages, means they make the links with the boy family and girl family. Is this a wholesome karma or unwholesome karma?
Who are we talking about? The matchmaker or the...
Yeah, matchmaker.
Well, I think that in the culture in which this is acceptable, or is the custom, India, of course, one example, then, it's not done with a malicious intent. I think that the matchmakers are, I presume, are trying to match people who can make a life together and make something out of a life together, while taking into other economic factors, and which seems quite realistic. Seemed to me that marriage is, it's a gamble. it's kind of like a lottery. You know, whether you choose your partner or one's chosen for you, there are no guarantees in a marriage that it will work out at all. And we just see this from divorce statistics. And if you add on to the divorce statistics, the married couples who are unhappy but just stick it out for the children, or because it could be too difficult to economically to separate, then making a good marriage and working at the marriage and creating that kind of we call it Kalyana Mitata, you know, a marriage when of good friends who support each other and become inseparable in terms of treading on their way on the path to enlightenment. You know, this is the ultimate goal, you know, to have that good spiritual friend as your mate. I mean, this seemed to me you can't ever know that beforehand. You know, you can choose someone who keeps precepts and who is has similar views and goals, but even then, it's not a sure thing. So, I think that probably I'm guessing that the percentage of couples who accept the choice of their parents and then make a good marriage is probably probably as many or even maybe even more successful than those people who choose their own mates, and think it's a matter of putting, really making a commitment and sticking to it. So I can't see that it would be bad karma for matchmakers if they're doing it with the best interests of everyone involved. But how this particular custom is adapting or should adapt to modern times, that's something that I think families will have to work out for themselves. Probably not the role of monks to tell people how to do these things.
Pandey, one more question. They say that is meditation can help to the world in this pandemic?
Well, yeah, I mean, in what sense? I mean, in terms of the stress levels that people are experiencing, through concern and worry about catching the virus or family members catching the virus, or loss of jobs and financial economic difficulties, then meditation can help, because with meditation we're just learning to recognize worry as worry, stress as stress, and not getting caught up in those worrying thoughts. And so it's just basic mental hygiene. Meditation is very, very good, just to keep sane in at this difficult time in our history. As regards some kind of immunity from given through meditation, not so sure about that. I certainly wouldn't guarantee that someone who has a very bright, still mind would be safe from any kind of infection. I think meditation can help your immune system in one level or another, but not something that you would want to take a bet on or use it as a pretext or an excuse for being careless about using a mask or social distancing and so on. So you use common sense and being very careful in those ways. So meditation can just help your mental health, obviously. If you were to go on a very long solitary retreat, then yeah, that would be probably a good way to keep you free of the virus or from spreading it to anyone else.
Okay. Big question. I found most of my problems comes from the fact that I feel I am insufficient. That's why I always rushing and striving to become someone who is sufficient. Do I have any advice on the sense of insufficiency?
Yes, in fact, the one translator. I'm trying to think his name, uses the word lack or insufficiency as a translation for dukkha, for suffering. So it's like the essence of suffering, the sense of something missing, something not right, insufficiency. But it's important just to recognize that is a perception and a thought, and maybe, you know, many people who have this kind of thought are people who've had very demanding parents who have made their love for the child conditional on certain exam results or certain kinds of behavior, you know, and this, so the child gets this feeling, whatever I do, it's not good enough for my parents or for my father or mother, and that leaves this general feeling of being not good enough. But it's just like a filter we put on the mind, and it's a habit of mind. So we say, insufficient for what? You know, there's no test, you know, that you have to go through, you know. Good enough. So, yeah, you're not perfect, and sure, you've got plenty of faults and vices, and yeah, that's normal. You don't have to be perfect. But the very fact that you're here and you're asking questions, it means that you have a right view to a certain extent, and you are trying to be a good person and to develop on the path. So just be very patient and just simply recognize this voice in your head that's saying, you know, you're not good enough, or it's not enough, or more. And the fact is, you know, the sensual world of forms and sounds and all these things, it can't ever satisfy. It won't ever take that feeling away, except for a very short period. And then it's back again. It's just like scratching an itch, and then the itch comes back even worse than it was before. So if we're looking at the sensual world as a remedy for this feeling of insufficiency, then we're really setting ourselves up for endless disappointment. But to start up, yeah, good enough. It's good enough. And appreciate what you've got. Developing sense of gratitude is a very good way of dealing with this on a fundamental level. You see how fortunate I am. And all the things I've been given in my life. You just write those down. All the things in your life that you feel gratitude for. And you start to feel, yeah, actually, I'm not so bad. I'm not too so bad at all.
Pante, it's already late, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's 9:30 there. So thank you very much for all. Sadhu, 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 Pante.
I'm sorry if I haven't answered everyone's question.
No, everything is very well. Yes.
Thank you for your patience, Bante.
Okay, so I'll say good night.
Thank you, Bante.
Thank you, Bante.
For listening us our questions.
Thank you, Bante, for giving us time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
So we are closing now?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you, organizers, for this beautiful event.
And Kai Bante is still there, I think. Kai Sangai Sai Kokonalake? Bante na? Okay. Bante, with your permission, I'm ending the meeting now. This one.